Welcome, allies, the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, as Uranus trickster genius stations to go forward, outward in all of our lives, we're going to welcome the spirit of Robert Anton Wilson through his biographer, Gabriel Kennedy, a.k.a. Propanon, author of Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson, because we need this narrative guiding voice for now. Oh, that's wonderful. So just a little preamble about the perfection of our timing. I have Robert Anton Wilson, whom we will introduce to those who don't know him. I know him more now, and I feel more resonance after this splendid book. Oh my God, I want to teach a course on this book. So just the perfection can't hear me. We're working backstage to work on these things. So the south node of the moon right now is at 28 plus Virgo, one of my favorite degrees. And when Robert Anton Wilson was born, his south node was 28 plus Virgo. So it's perfect. The image for that degree is, in a cave overhung with twisted roots, a seeker pores over the glowing pages of an illuminated alchemical manuscript. And we go, oh, that's fantastic. Okay. We'll weave that in. The moon right now is at 29 plus Aquarius, which is exactly on Robert Anton Wilson's Venus and Vesta, 29 plus Aquarius, whose image is strange white flowers are blooming in the midnight ruins of Babylon. Ooh, the new moon just behind us at 9 plus Aquarius is where Venus was when Robert Anton Wilson died. The image for that degree is a man plans anew, unspoiled by waning popularity as an ideal. Well, getting back in tune with the times, we'll introduce, you know, the wonderful author Gabriel Kennedy in seconds, and Robert Anton Wilson is coming alive now. I'm really, really reading this book. I feel like every chapter of my life is being hummed with synchronicity. And Mars in the sky is on Robert Anton Wilson's Pluto, and Robert Anton Wilson in his chart has this thing called Thor's Hammer, which is from his Mercury to Jupiter to Chiron. And Thor's Hammer is the capacity to sweep corruption out of the halls of governance. So it's like, oh, that's great. His rising degree, he gave his birth time as 6 a.m., but it works. The image for that is 10 logs lie in front of an archway leading to darker woods. And we go, oh, and Uranus, as it stations and goes forward for all of us now, we'll honor that, is squaring his Saturn, which is also David Graeber's son. And David Graeber, again, fantastic historian who is also an ancestor. So the gang's all here. Gabriel Kennedy is a multimedia artist whose work has appeared in boingboing.net, mondo2000.com, also on his websites, chapelperilous.us and prop-anon.com. He first interviewed Robert Anton Wilson in 2003 and was an original member of Wilson's remote learning website, the Maybe Logic Academy. Chapel Perilous is his first book. Welcome, Gabriel Kennedy.
Hi, Carolyn. Thank you. Thank you for having me today. Great to be here.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, it's good. So already the synchronicities are here, and navigating uncertainty. And one of my precepts for the last 30 years has been believe nothing, entertain possibilities. So I feel kinned with Robert Anton Wilson. That's so great. And so maybe just to, and also, as I mentioned to you backstage in email, I was in pursuit of astrology, I was a Grail scholar. So Chapel Perilous, yes, and teasing it into now, as you do at the beginning of the book, guide us into Chapel Perilous, perhaps.
Oh, for sure. And I hope, is the audio sounding okay? I know there was a bit of technical difficulties trying to connect. So I hope that there's enough bars on my phone here to, all my words to be heard. Very indicative of Chapel Perilous.
Right. Well, we knock on wood. We're navigating uncertainty, right? All those things. But you can hear us now, right? Yes.
I can hear you. I hope you guys and the audience can hear me. And but yes, thank you, Carolyn, very much. And as you said in your email, to me, you were one of the original people who received the message and read Illuminatus trilogy when it first came out. And
Yeah.
I wanted to, create a book, a biography that went beyond just a factual kind of representation of someone's life. And I wanted to make it as visceral and sort of humane as possible, and just sort of transport the reader there, just give them like an over-the-shoulder shot of Wilson's life, the phrase Chapel Perilous itself comes from, as you know, a great Arthurian poem called The Death of Arthur, though it was written in French, the title anyway, and it was written by a British writer named I think Thomas Malory. And there's some uncertainty about the exact identity of Thomas Malory. There's different, sort of like Shakespeare, there's different interpretations of who this person might be, because the text was produced in the 16th century. And in that text, which is about Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, there's the mention of the Chapel Perilous, or the Perilous Chapel, where a intrepid traveler, a knight on the path, must enter or finds oneself within while on the path for the Holy Grail, the Chalice of Wisdom. And once one is inside such chapel, it takes a while to recognize, to get one's understanding and footing that, oh, here I am in a perilous chapel. I'm suddenly in a danger zone that is unlike any other that I've encountered thus far on this path. And Wilson, sort of popularized the term. I would say he's the, well, for him and T.S. Eliot are perhaps the two main writers that have really sort of elevated this sort of side story of the Grail Quest into something of its own. T.S. Eliot, of course, he had it in his poem The Wasteland, and he was influenced by another writer named Jessie Weston, who she wrote about the Grail tradition as a tradition of initiation in her book, I believe it was From Grail to Romance, From
Yeah.
Ritual to Romance. I believe that was Jessie Weston's
Yes.
book. And of course, T.S. Eliot was greatly influenced by that. And then Bob, who loved modernist poetry, was very much influenced by The Wasteland. And I guess that phrase stuck with him. And then he created his own spin of the phrase, from, delocating it from a specific place in a mythic adventure to a psychological state that pretty much can exist or does exist within all of us. And it's a state of great uncertainty. However, the events that occur in one's life, the cause of these events, one wonders, are they from supernatural forces or, normal nature, but we then project upon, supernatural interpretations from our own imagination. So, Wilson took that wonderful trip for most of his career of, intentionally engaging his imagination and using it as a tool for so much in his life. I mean, it was, his mind and his imagination that pretty much allowed him to pick himself up by his bootstraps out of a harsh beginning, a harsh first act of his life. Born and raised in the South Shores of Brooklyn during the Great Depression, in, as he described, an Irish Catholic ghetto, a place called Garrison Beach. At the age of two, he was diagnosed with polio. That was in the year 1934. Wilson born in 1932, and there was no cure for polio at that time. So his mother went on a search and found an alternative medicine that was considered quackery at that time, but this thing called the Sister Kenny method.
Yeah.
You know, a woman who created that is, you know, an alternative medicine hero now. And, you know, so Wilson from the very beginning was constantly, you know, learning the importance of, you know, movement and how important it is to stay focused on a certain trajectory. You know, the metaphor of just moving on up the hill, you know, his mind is completely directed towards constant transcendence. And
right.
I mean, when one is within the Chapel Perilous, that's something to keep in mind, perhaps, looking for the way out.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a prison.
Well, yeah,
a prison break.
We want to tease it into resonance for everyone here, right? Because in Chapel Perilous, you leave all certainty behind. Yes, believe nothing, entertain possibilities is my thing, but kin with his, you know, and we go. Right, and then beware of Fenords. Beware of Fenords. I remember this from, you know, when I read Illuminatus trilogy. It really had the Grail when it came out. My wonderful friend Jacob Pearl, most sensible boyfriend I ever had, who went on to become a Polish Jewish Zen master, introduced me to the Illuminatus trilogy. He said it's too wonderful. And at the same time, also reading Stanislaw Lem, The Futurological Congress, very kinned. I'm sure Robert Anton Wilson must have read that. But you do a splendid job, really, at the beginning of the context, and again, how it's humming, you know, and the right-wing usurpation of occultism. You mentioned William Dudley Pelley, anti-Semitic Hitler supporter, you know, who had a near-death experience in Altadena, California. Everything's one story. Everything's one story, right? And was receiving, you know, information from the Syrian thing, from the star Sirius, I think. Anyway, so yeah, mm-hmm. Communications from Sirius, right? So we get this mix, right? And there are no reliable narrators, right? And Robert Anton Wilson is great that way. Delving into, you know, conspiracy theories, what's crackpot, what's real, what's, you know, all of that. And this so hums, it so hums, yeah, the Sister Kenny. And then, you know, you weaving in his influences, and I go, oh, me too. He listened to the shadow. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows. And it's like, oh, that's great. Ouija board. There's also, right, in which somebody brings a Ouija board over to his house, you say, and he asked the Ouija board, when would the World War II end? And it said August 14th, 1945. Pretty close, right? I can't remember the exact date. And then I don't know if you know a really esoteric, amazing book called The Changing Light at Sandover by James Merrill.
No.
It's... No, well, I hope we teach a course together. We could really do this. Because The Changing Light at Sandover by James Merrill, who was a poet, he got all of his really intriguing friends, not unlike Robert Anton Wilson. It would be, we can sort of think of that, of all the people he met in his life. So, assembled. And it's the best use of Ouija board, like, ever. He had Maya Deren, who'd been doing a lot of work in Haiti. And the whole book is there, receiving from these spirits, but it's all in rhyme and it's all incredibly pertinent. So that's just an aside over there, the Ouija board. And then, you know, Irish working class, me too. And then all of the influences that you list throughout the book, and I find this so inspiring. It's like I want to go back and reread everything. The Golden Bough and James Joyce and Carl Jung and UFOs and H.P. Lovecraft, very important to myself. And you mentioned that Robert Anton Wilson thought that H.P. Lovecraft was processing collective anxiety through horror. That's a really fun idea.
Oh, for sure. I mean... And not just, you know, regular gory type horror, but the horror of the worst kind, like the deepest existential horror. I think that's a jewel Wilson really received from Lovecraft. this impression that there are beings that are more ancient, more mysterious, and more evil than we could even conceive, or more indifferent than we could even conceive, where, you know, a blind God created this universe, perhaps, you know, mixing in some Gnostic interpretation, and that overlord does not care at all one iota about the comings and goings of humanity. And Wilson, you know, that impression that he picked up from Lovecraft, I think it really solidified in him in his kind of late teens and early 20s, when perhaps he was dealing with a lot of angst of just living in a world where nuclear holocaust is possible. As you know, he was greatly impacted by the atomic bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima at the end of World War II. And, you know, I really wanted to relate that in the book, that, you know, it's almost considered ancient history now in this, you know, crisis of presentism that we live in, you know, where so many things that happened last year are just, you know, ejected down the memory hole of, like, you know, a collective amnesia almost, you know. And that, you know, 70 some odd years ago, 70 years ago, 80 years ago, there was a whole generation of Americans that were horrified at what their government did, you know, in order to, quote unquote, end a war, completely annihilating 200,000 people off the face of the earth in a matter of days. That is perhaps the personification, the epitome of what Lovecraft was essentially translating, if you will, was writing about. And Bob even saw a you know, a character within Lovecraft's fiction, I think it was called like Azathoth, who was the blind god of nuclear fury or something like that. And this was before the first nuclear or atomic bomb was even tested. So, you know, Wilson is attuned already to this sort of precognitive abilities that artists may hold. And, you know, he himself, well, other people can testify that he, you know, is touched with the same gift, if you will, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of intuitive second sight to really anticipate what's coming around the bend. And I think that's another thing I really wanted to, you know, get in the book, like Wilson's, you know, presaging abilities. And it makes sense then that he's influenced by these people like Lovecraft, who he thought were able to really translate the deeper sort of collective anxiety, as you mentioned. And then also people like Joyce, or a writer like Joyce, who Wilson certainly thought was able to tap into what he called the non-local mind, you know, or, you know, that collective unconscious, if you will. And he also thought that Joyce predicted the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima based on a line in Finnegan's Wake. You know, he thought, yeah, he was pretty firm in that thought. But, you know, Bob, he was a liberal, a flexible thinker. But so that impact, though, of the total destruction, you know, from World War II, like so many young Americans, he was influenced by that. And it left I think he did find some existentialist like healing, if you will, you know, just being able to and searching for, you know, don't give me any filler. Just tell me how it is. But what, let's just cut through the crap. You know, let's look at really what's going on. And, you know, I think that his early years were training for that, you know, to quickly see through, you know, what he called BS, you know, other people's belief systems, you know. And, you know, and then there were early artists and heroes and influences, you know, not just the intellectual influences, but also Orson Welles was such a huge influence on him in his early life. He was his favorite living artist for, you know, decades, because he essentially discovered Orson Welles, like, you know, with The Shadow, but even before then, with Welles's War of the Worlds broadcast that was broadcast, I believe, on Halloween 1938. So Wilson writes about having a distinct memory, you know, at the age of six, listening to this sort of meta, you know, where they were reaching outside of the communication technology of the radio and instilling real fear in people that there was an alien invasion and whatnot happening. And so, of course, Bob is greatly influenced by this, someone's ability to, you know, really change your consciousness through communication, through art. And, you know, Bob took that throughout his whole career and just kept exploring this rubric, you know, throughout all his work and all his life. And I think he created some great, you know, pathways to travel for others. He left great maps for people
He
to travel.
did. He did. And I feel. I mean, I am so much more informed and so much more kinned. Like, oh my goodness, that's good. And then just for all of our listening accomplice teams, you know, to go to, you know, when do we become anti-authoritarians, right? And, you know, and for him, it was the brutality of the Catholic Church, and I raised my hand. I didn't have the brutality, but you know, for all of us now, we're all thinking about what are awakenings in our life? That's the Uranus going forward right now. And I do remember, you know, I'm young enough. I'm playing in my dollhouse. That's and I'm considering the Nicene Creed, going, only one God, only one Church. And I'm going, no. It really was a moment. And you do a great job of, again, bringing up, I think, for all of us, like, when do we decide to no longer subjugate ourselves, our sovereignty, to an external authority, right? And you know, and you know, Eddie Nix, who introduced us, it was a wonderful ally, friend of show, 2 weeks ago, great show. And the, you know, being anarcho-entheo animists, right, which Robert Anton Wilson really was, right? And then you bring in, you know, Wilhelm Reich and The Mass Psychology of Fascism. These are all books we want to read, you know, Northrop Frye. I go, yeah, no, but that was very important to me. Buddhism, yes, me too. And then you have Bob meets Joseph Campbell. Me too. And we'll get to George Carlin. But I feel, you know, so resonant. And what you've done, your dedicated craft in delineating Robert Anton Wilson's incredibly deeply cultivated, worked, you know, autonomous craft is inspiring to me and to maybe all who listen and all who pick up this really great book, Chapel Perilous. It's like you also delineate, you know, he's in despair, he's going to kill himself, he drinks a lot, he walks to a bridge. He's going to do it. He's going to jump into the water. But then there's a plaque on the bridge. You'll have to remind me, and it's someone who is expressing deep dedication, and that dedication, he goes, right, that's the way to go. I'm going to become a more dedicated person. So do you remember what the plaque was, or you write about this, yeah?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yes, that was such a huge moment for Bob. Yeah, it was a plaque that was dedicated to the Roebling family, and the Roeblings were basically a father, then a son, and his wife. You know, over a couple of generations, basically built the Brooklyn Bridge. And you know, of course, them and many workers, they oversaw obviously the engineering and the total construction of the Brooklyn Bridge. And yeah, the whole backstory to that, when Bob saw that plaque, he was young and you know, brokenhearted. He, you know, was very unsure of his position in life and what he was going to do. He had not yet chosen to really be a writer. Although he secretly wanted to be a writer, he had told his parents very early on, at around the age 13, that he wanted to be a writer once or twice,
But
and both of his parents.
wait, you write that he, at age 12, he wrote his first novel, The Age of Miracles, about a humble humble person with miracle powers. So
yes,
there's that too. It goes way back. All right, yeah, back to yourself. But just for everybody, mm-hmm. for all of us, you know, just to feel like, when did we in moments of despair find dedication through another, going, their life is really dedicated. You know, and I think that's what you've done for us and the culture now, as we are in Chapel Perilous with, you know, the hearings, you know, we're going on today, you know, to install further the devolutionary nadir of our rogue species. You know, we've elected the Inquisition oligarchy hybrid. We really want Robert Anton Wilson and your offering too right now, going, oh boy. And then all of us, you know, to go, well, where do we, you know, encounter the dedication of another? The dedication of Gabriel Kennedy, it took you 8 years to write this book. It's well worth it. It's really crafted. You know, your dedication writing about somebody else's incredible, long, lifelong, always learning, challenging, questioning, brewing things together, you know, Buddhism and anarchism and Wilhelm Reich and Northrop Frye, you know, again, we find the liberating voices even in academia and Buddhism and Bob meets Joseph Campbell. And then, and George Carlin, and George Carlin and he became great friends, right?
Oh, yes. Over many years. Yeah, 100%, yes. The dedication that is absolutely necessary to follow through on a long-term vision, that was just something that Wilson had it from a very young age, yet he was able to refine it and strengthen this resolve. And absolutely, absolutely 100%, Carolyn. Yes. Like gaining inspiration through others. Wilson had a tremendous capacity to, you know, keep going back to a practice of opening his heart, despite some of the most horrible things that could happen to a parent, from the murder of his teenage daughter and then the, descent or, you know, onslaught of schizophrenia on his teenage son that happened immediately after his daughter was murdered. And for Wilson to remain active even and to just not shut down from, you know, traumatic events he was born in Chapel Perilous and he remained in Chapel Perilous, yet he was able to hold firm and stand firm. And also, you know, show people, you know, ways to break out of the prison as any true Irish rebel would, you know, showing people how to break out of prison. And he himself broke out many times. But, you know, perhaps that's an irony of this existence that, you know, the Bodhisattva vow is the Bodhisattva vow for a reason, that one may forego total nirvanic illumination and escape to help others get there themselves. That perhaps there's more satisfaction in that. Sometimes it's nice taking mushrooms alone, but sometimes it's way more fun to share mushrooms with your friends and you can all have fun. And so Bob, you know, he remained open. He kept his heart open, which was a real practice. He took many hits throughout his life. And I think most of his work, if not all of his work with magic and neurology and all these great exercises that he recommended to people that he himself did was always aimed at transcending and raising one's heart to the sky, if you will, right? Very true. And connecting it to the earth, like to be that channel for as much illumination and light as you possibly can, as much as you could possibly withstand.
We're going to come back on this. We're going to have a very short but pertinent break music. It's one of my favorite things. It's Cheshire Kitten by S.J. Tucker. Just a minute or two of that. My perfect for now ally guest is Gabriel Kennedy, a.k.a. Prop Anon, author of Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson, because we need this narrative guiding voice, all of us, now. And we'll be right back to explore entheogens and marijuana and Aldous Huxley and Peter Kropotkin and many things to and the Discordians and how to address chaos magic, which is around us all. All right, we'll be right back after this pertinent music. Here we go.
I grew up seeing things a little differently, appearing, disappearing, hardly innocent, nor tied down to the ground. I learned to roll and tumble with the punches, glory in my stripes and spots, walk by invisible and never make a sound. But heavy is the crown that's always hidden, tender is the heart you never see. Hard and fast shines the grin that we flash, but there's a vulnerable stripe or two on me. Maybe any place outside a wonderland is not for me, my friend. If I leave my grin behind, remind me that we're all mad here and it's okay. Sun up, sun down, the shadows hide me down in Wonderland, Wonderland. Nobody knows the way, but if you find it in your dreams, you can find it at your day job somewhere south of hell. Take the path to left or right with just your gut to guide you. The story is not for anyone else to tell.
Go down the rabbit hole and out the other side. You can't go home in the middle of the magic carpet ride. You gotta greet the sun before his lovely daughter moon. You can't forsake the journey for the safety of your room
until you learn your learn to see and hear everybody loud and clear, but the truth comes down in riddles that are safe enough to share. That's how it is in songs you see, and stripes always looked good on me, whether or not I'm really there. Heavy is the burden of the wise ones when no one understands.
Allies, this is the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. That was Cheshire Kitten by S.J. Tucker, as a kind of support for all of us and for our guest, Gabriel Kennedy, the biographer of Robert Anton Wilson. I'm so glad to be reconnected with him and his dedication, so especially now for all of us, because we need all of this. And you can find, again, chapelperilous.us is one of Gabriel Kennedy's websites where you can find more of his writing. So we want to get to the Entheo party, discovers marijuana, right? And then very important as part of this search, you know, to never relinquish sovereignty to an authoritarian machine, you know, is what he writes through you, right? And then he's also reading Hidden Persuaders. I read that as a child, right? And mind manipulation, studying these things. It's one of the great things that you're unfurling is, you know, an answer to the question of what is it to be a cultivated human, a cultivated responsible human, a cultivated responsible Earth citizen, right? So, yeah, meeting Joseph Campbell for me was a good start. But then, complexity. Joseph Campbell voted for Reagan. Nobody's perfect, right? And George Carlin and Huxley and anarchism. Peter Kropotkin, and then the peyote and Playboy. All right, let's see. Where shall we go? So something I will need, I will, well, I guess in a quirky way here, I just wanted to read, whoops, there we go, okay, about many things. But I wanted to read what he says about his death. On January 6, 2007, Robert Anton Wilson wrote on his blog that according to several medical authorities, he would likely only have between 2 days and 2 months left to live. He closed this message with, "I look forward without dogmatic optimism, but without dread. I love you all, and I deeply implore you to keep the lasagna flying. Please pardon my levity. I don't see how to take death seriously. It seems absurd." And then he died 5 days later on January 11th at 4:50 a.m. I have the charts of all those things that are useful forever, just a week short of his 75th birthday, and his ashes were scattered off the Santa Cruz Beach boardwalk. All right, so yeah, you know, so reading a lot of this, part of me is like, maybe I shouldn't have moved to Santa Cruz. God, or when you were saying, you know, taking mushrooms on your own is good, but with friends, it's like, yes, you and me, and your partner Gabriel and Robert Anton Wilson's ghost, and you know, all of these really worthy people. Maybe you can help us navigate the significance of the number 23.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you too for just reminding me there of Bob's final act, his last moments. Yeah, that was an interesting part to write. And in terms of 23, this was, I suppose, Bob's magic number, his lucky number. He found great significance in this number. He found so much significance in the number 23. He inspired generations of people after him to have much see much significance with that same number, which says something about his magic, his great abilities to, make people enthusiastic about learning about things that he wrote about. But for him, and of course, which is also part of Wilson's magic, is that he's continuing a story. So the number 23 itself, he learned of this thing called the 23 Enigma, right? Which is involved synchronistically encountering the number 23 at odd and strange, sometimes great and sometimes scary and dark times. He writes in his book Cosmic Trigger Volume 1, which he published in 1977, that he first learned about the 23 Enigma from William S. Burroughs, the American beatnik satirical writer, in 1966. And then once he encountered, and this involved a story that Burroughs told Bob about a captain, a seafaring captain that he met when he was living in Tangiers, a man named Captain Clark, who told Burroughs that he had driven this sea ferry from port to port for 23 years, never having an accident in his life. But it just so happened that same day that he told Burroughs this, he crashed the ferry and everyone died. Burroughs said he heard this on the radio back at his room in Tangiers. And then later he went on an airplane and it was being flown by Captain Clark, or he read about this airplane being flown by Captain Clark. And the airplane crashed, and et cetera, and everyone died. And so Burroughs told Bob this, and this left a huge impression on Bob because he had, he loved Burroughs, right? So he loved Burroughs' work. And so he started seeing great significance in the number 23 for years after. 23 would pop up in all these instances.
Right, but clearly not always a positive augury. It's just a like a noteworthy
Yeah,
like
very
well,
true.
yeah. So there's that, and then we honor synchronicity, and I should say that we're talking now at a propitious time that I've been looking forward to, which is Jornes' principle of genius, nature's evolutionary trickster genius from retrograde, which is inward going forward today. So we're really dedicating this show to your work and to Robert Anton Wilson and to that in everyone listening, to everybody's customized, unique, liberating trickster self, brewed from everything we've ever studied, right? So I love the way it's syncretized. So it is, entheogens, you write about his discovering marijuana, really huge big thing early, and peyote, really huge big thing, where he sees Mescalito, right, as an actual being, right? And this is an interesting thought, like, again, what's real, what's not, which is he's exploring, you're exploring, we're all exploring that. But I remember with Terence McKenna, Entheo retreat in Mexico. And I told Terence about my friend Dr. Wu, who was a sane person in many ways, cultivated, he got Steely Dan off of heroin. They wrote a song about him. But he was visited by these 6-foot-tall praying mantis beings from another warlike planet. And people thought, oh, he's crazy, whatever. But Terence said, oh, yeah, no, that's old Shovelhead. we run into him every now and then on the astral plane when we're engaged in entheogens. So there's characters, right? Just the idea of, you know, believe nothing, entertain possibilities, right? So there's the entheo part, the anarcho-entheo part, which I like going together, and the animism part, because you write about him saying, you know, with the peyote, he felt, even when he wasn't using it, but he felt more kinned and communicative with the plants in his garden, right? That it opens us to that. What a good thing. And you know, precognitive things. But, yeah, and then his friendship with Leary and Richard Alpert, and it's like, this is all my teen years. It's like, it's all this tremendous brew. And then All Hail Discordia. I'm going to reread your book a whole bunch of times, and maybe the Illuminatus trilogy as well. I haven't read it, but it leaves a mark, you know, for anybody who's read it way back, you know. But did you reread it again for this book?
Yes, I did. Yeah, it was.
And does it hold up? Does it
go back to?
Does it hold up for now?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Well, I think it definitely does.
It's Dealey Plaza and, you know, and conspiracies and levitating the Pentagon, which he was involved with. You know, I mean, all of these things. And, you know, again, this rich brew of entheo, anarcho, dedicated to collective well-being, you know, serious dedicated student in so many ways. Yeah, and his friend Thornley, who knew Lee Harvey Oswald, who was a soldier, contrarian, Marxist, speaking Russian, there's all that thing. And then we get to the Discordians and Eris. I can't read my own notes here. But maybe you can guide us into where I will be rereading this, because it's so complex. You say, Wilson, always a fan of art projects involving paper, began handing out Discordian business cards with slogans that read, "There is no enemy anywhere. There is no friend anywhere." And it says his favorite card to hand out was one of Greg Hill's creations, which stated that the person in possession of it was now a Discordian pope. You go on with that. But don't you think that now is an excellent time to be, you know, liberating cultural hijinks, to be handing out cards? Don't you think this is, you know, part of what we need to encourage in ourselves, our liberating trickster, liberating cultural hijinks quality? Does that feel a part of your dedication?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's never been a better time for people to get in touch with this part of themselves, their mythiopoetic, godly, goddess natures. And I mean, especially you could, seeing who has become president twice now. All doors are open. You know, it's a everything must go sort of feeling sale. Like we live, you know, chaos never ended, as Hakim Bey once said. You know, we live in it.
Yeah.
It's our own, you know, projections to want to place order on a flow that exists, but we may not have a full understanding or comprehension of it. It's overwhelming. And again, this is why I think Bob is great. I'm constantly inspired by Bob, and why Illuminatus is still extremely relevant, why most of his work is extremely relevant, you know, because he creates a multidimensional fabric, a lattice, you know, like this, to really look at the finer threads of what composes the reality around us. You know, if you have the words to you know, signify the chemicals that are at play within your body right now and circulating around you and, you know, without you. And then if you're able to think in these ways, right, like that's his main thing. His magic is his word magic is psychedelic. You know, Arturo Ali, another great magician who just, you know, recently passed away, and a great writer himself, you know, he wrote about seeing Bob read the beginning stages of his book Schrodinger's Cat Trilogy in the late 70s. And he was like, this is magic. The way that this guy is putting words together is magic. And I think Wilson was very aware. He was that adroit. He was that good at putting words together. He knew what he was doing. You know, he knew how to hypnotize people and seduce readers with his work. And this is why he used conspiracy theories so much and the idea of paranoia, because like a contemporary of his, Philip K. Dick, utilized the idea of alien invasion. You know, Bob utilized paranoia. But to touch back on, you know, the number 23, because I don't want to diminish the value in the number 23 at all. Like Bob, he used the number 23 as like a medium of transmission, a doorway to access, you know, the antipodes of his own mind. You know, he utilized the number 23 with the serious mysteries, with Crowley's work, with psychedelics, and he did it in the 70s, you know, and the results was Cosmic Trigger Volume 1. You know, he's an artist because he's on the cusp. He's surfing the wave of the zeitgeist, because I imagine I was, you know, I wasn't around at that time, but from looking at all the great records, Crowley was a big influence during the 70s. And so Bob was a huge voice of, as Alan Moore said, you know, he got into Crowley because of Bob. You know, Bob was able to be a multi-force aggregator and communicator. He took all this information. He was the countercultural public intellectual par excellence, you know. And I think that's why his work has even more value today almost than back then, because as the term today is, he did not get all the flowers that he deserved while he was living. His influence and his impact is that great upon current culture that people really deserve to know who this guy is. It's not, you know, you need to know. It's like you will be enriched by learning about this guy, his approach to living in this, you know, post-World War II, post-everything, you know, culture. He never gives up searching for humanity.
Did Robert Anton Wilson, did he know Philip K. Dick?
They were friends, yeah. Acquaintances.
Right. I want to do mushrooms with right. Well, apparently LSD was crucial to George Carlin, right? And we never got to trip with Joseph Campbell, but it's like to convene the council, like Alan Moore, Philip K. Dick, you know, Robert Anton Wilson, and Robert Anton Wilson's wife, who seemed very wonderful. We got to throw some women in there too, and I just want to read just a little bit. At times. He claimed to have perceived encounters with magical entities, right? This is an interesting conversation to have. When asked whether these entities seemed real, he answered they seemed real enough, although not as real as the IRS, but easier to get rid of, right? And later decided that his experiences may have emerged from just my right brain hemisphere talking to my left, right? We don't know, right? He warned against beginners using occult practice, blah, 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 all those kinds of things. But yeah, and we would converse. I'd go, you know, yeah, Aleister Crowley, I think, is somebody to kind of transcend, you know, in a way. I mean, many of us started off magic and theory and practice and then was like, he's kind of an abuser of power. But it's all in that rich mixture. And then All Hail Discordia. Can you guide us more into the Discordia realm and the whole realm of chaos magic and what should we do now?
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, definitely. So Bob met the two founders of Discordianism, Kerry Thornley and Greg Hill, in 1967, after Thornley sent Wilson a letter to where Bob was working at the Playboy offices, and they sparked a very lively correspondence from then on, Wilson and Thornley. They were kindred spirits, and Thornley told Bob about the goddess of chaos, Eris, and told Bob about the vision that he and Greg had at a bowling alley in Whittier, California in 1959, when the goddess Eris appeared at the end of maybe lane 23. I'm making that last part up. But she appeared at the bowling alley to them, and you know, she let them know that we live in a world of chaos, and you better get used to it. From which they then formed their religion, Discordianism. And they had a first sort of generation of Discordianism when, they formed Discordianism, and then Thornley went to the military And in the military, Thornley met Lee Harvey Oswald because they were serving together at a military base in El Toro, I believe. And after the military, Thornley settled in New Orleans with Greg Hill. And funny enough, Lee Harvey Oswald was also in New Orleans, not far from where Thornley lived, yet the two never ran into each other, according to Thornley. And while Hill and Thornley were in New Orleans, they formed the first generation of Discordians. Drama ensued. Fast forward to 1967, when Thornley reaches out to Robert Anton Wilson. This is sort of like a second generation of Discordianisms that's sort of born, if you will, and Wilson is a part of that. Wilson loves what Hill and Thornley are putting down. Wilson also gets his buddy and co-worker Robert Shea, and later the co-author of Illuminatus trilogy, Robert Shea, into Discordianism as well. They both love it because Discordianism, you know, as they said, was either a joke disguised as a religion or a religion disguised as a joke. Jesse Walker, the author of The United States of Paranoia, has said that Wilson is a part of the generation, and he's kind of like the forefront of what he called the ironic style. And that's looking at all these things with an ironic state of mind, obviously, like conspiracy theories and some of the, you know, worst stuff that could happen in life. Just looking at it with an ironic grin, if you will. And Discordianism is sort of that take on things. It's a sort of Buddhist, ironic Buddhist screed that is extremely inspiring. Because for one, you know, it's the rise of the goddess again, and, you know, the rise of Eris, who, you know, maybe when it's sort of based on the notion of the law of fives, and that, you know, evolution develops in five stages. And it's a cyclical cosmology that the Discordians promulgate. So, you know, there's not a linear progression, if you will. There's a world of cyclical universes. And every time people seek to get something together, eventually chaos would ensue again and things would sort of break apart. And bringing in the number 20, calling back the number 23, hexagram 23 of the I Ching, as Wilson wrote, you know, signifies or is translated as to break apart. So things come together, things fall apart, and things keep flowing and recreating again. This was pretty much the heart of, you know, Discordianism. And in many ways, like the religious part, it's a process philosophy. You know, it's one of constant movement and momentum. And of course, Wilson was totally inspired by this. And it was also, as I said, a joke religion too. So these guys were wildly funny. And not just these guys, there were early women Discordian members as well. You know, people like Lady Fab, who she was a Discordian member. She worked at, I believe it was Ramparts magazine for many years. And, you know, she was a good friend of Wilson. And they really took it there. They as a group, then, so that's the philosophy, but as just a group of wild freaknik beatniks in the 60s, you know, they instituted these things called Project Jakes, which were letters sent to various people that they thought needed to be, you know, get a send up or a wind up. Usually it were groups, you know, organizations that promoted some sort of conspiratorial viewpoint of the world, like the John Birch Society or something. And they would tell them that, hey, we're the Illuminati. The Discordians are the Illuminati. We're responsible for everything, good and bad. So over here, you know, bring all that smoke, if you will. And it was a sort of like an acid-infused hilarity party. As Wilson wrote, they viewed anyone who was paranoid enough to think certain crazy things deserved be laughed at. That's not too far off from how skeptics tend to think.
We're winding our way slowly to a close, but I just want to you know, honor further, you know, for those who have not read the Illuminatus trilogy or don't know Robert Anton Wilson's work, this book, Chapel Perilous, is a great way in. But to honor, you know, like our discourse here, the Illuminatus trilogy, it's always tongue in cheek, like don't be certain. So, but it ties everything together, right? Dealey Plaza, the Kennedy assassination, Levitt hitting the Pentagon, you know, Aleister Crowley, you know, and it's a brilliant, hilarious meta narrative that's useful to us. And when you mentioned irony, ironic style, right? I'm big fans of irony. The show is a big fan of irony. That, you know, linguistics people in England said, to the degree to which people are ironic is the degree to which they can have compassion. I'll speak really quickly here because we're winding down. Because to be ironic is part of what you're doing and part of what Robert Anton Wilson does. It requires holding at least two stories at once. What is and what should be, which we all want to do right now, and what is and what people are pretending it is, which we all want to do, and then to be compassionate is to hold, you know, ever more and more stories. So we're we're on our way out, but let me give you the, if you have a liberating blessing you'd like to send out to our fellow Earth citizens at this time of navigating chaos, is there any sentence blessing woof that you'd like to spiral forth? Spirals come from the number five.
Sure. I mean, I guess I'll just, and thank you again, Carolyn, so much for having me on. And I'll just leave with the words that Bob left with, which was, for parting words, you know, amor hilaritas. And when you think of amor, think of Richard St. Victor saying, where there is love, there is correct vision. And when you think of hilaritas, think of Giamesto Plaithon, who said, gods can be recognized by their cheerfulness.
Oh, that's so great. That's so great. That's right. And he does talk about, you know, the discipline of optimism, right? To be satirical, right? Again, irony, yes. Sarcasm, no. Sarcasm is imprisoning. Irony is liberating. And your wonderful work and book. So again, our guest today is Gabriel Kennedy, a.k.a. Propanon, author of Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson. I'm going to be savoring this book for a long time. And thanks always to Kirsten Thomas, wonderful, indefatigable board up. Thanks again, Gabriel, for your dedication, which is humming our dedication too. This is Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com, or on Patreon, Visionary Activist Show, and we will reconvene next week. Woof.